Ready? Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to call the Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, January the 19th, 2005. It's now about 8:37 a.m. We have present Senator Terrio, Senator Huggins, Senator French, and understand Senator Guest, you're online with us this morning?
Can you gavel to gavel?
Okay. Thank you, Senator Guest, for being with us. We are going to continue with our testimony and our work on Senate Bill 56, and I understand that some work has been done by the Attorney General's office. Ms. Parks, do you have some comments for us this morning, answers to questions? Maybe we could ask you to come up, if you would, and go back on the record.
Chairman, are we on backslash F? Just getting
yes.
Up to speed. Thank you.
We're still looking at backslash F on this bill for Foxtrot.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Susan Parks. I'm the Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. Actually, there were some proposed changes in response to questions that came up. And actually, Deputy Commissioner Parker, there were two of them that had to do, one with periodic sentencing and one having to do with the delegation of probation conditions by the judge to a probation officer. And actually, I would defer to Deputy Commissioner Parker on those, and then I could address some other questions that came
okay.
up.
Okay. All right. Ms. Parker, welcome to the committee this morning. If you'll put yourself on the record for us, please.
Good morning. Portia Parker, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Corrections. Sorry, I just walked in. With the two questions from yesterday that I have answers for, one of them regarding the periodic sentencing. In discussions with the assistant AG who works with our department on these requests and deals with the attorneys in the court system regarding these issues, is that it has become less and less over the years since the case that I highlighted yesterday. We have between 2 and 10 requests a year issuing of periodic sentences now. It has become much less of a problem since the Court of Appeals decided the Felix case in 2002, although we are still experiencing judges ignoring that ruling. One just happened in Fairbanks recently where they granted a periodic or a release of a prisoner on a medical-type court-ordered furlough to get dental care, but even though our medical department had said they would provide limited care since the prisoner was about to be released in 8 months, well, 4 to 8 months. Anyway, so then we had to release her, book her back in, release her again for a follow-up, and book her back in all within those months prior to release. So in discussions with the assistant AG, we do believe that this would help giving clear statutory guidelines with the proposed amendment that we discussed yesterday.
Okay.
The second question was regarding the offender who had been given a periodic sentence for being released during the summer months or fishing season. That was an 8-year sentence for sexual abuse of a minor in the second degree. The offender also had 5 priors, including attempted homicide, 2 assaults, and a contributing to the delinquency of a minor that would be sexual abuse of the minor in the second degree under current law. That offender was given 8 years with 5 years suspended with a 3-year sentence where we were required to release. The sentence is for several months and then release again for several months, like January, February, March, release for April, and then back in for May, release for June, back in July, August, September, October, November, release for December. That, and those are the kinds of cases that we have concern with and are also very problematic.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator French.
Has there been any thought about maybe just restricting periodic sentences to sentences at the lower end of the scale, and just sort of putting a line in the sand and saying, you know, we have decided that there's a certain, you know, level of severity beyond which we will not allow a periodic sentence. And I was thinking about this morning, and I guess if I were going to invent a number, I'd pick 2 years and say, you know, just there's a certain, you know, parameter that we're willing to work with you within, but beyond that, the seriousness of your offense requires that you go to prison, stay there, and then when you get out, you can start to reassemble, you know, your life.
That's some of the discussion that we had yesterday prior to you being able to get here, as to where, if we want to establish a upper limit, and so that's part of the reason that we're getting this report this morning.
And we're on that point.
Other questions on that point? Go ahead, Ms. Parker. Anything else?
That concludes the.
I have a question. Was there any kind of a justification for that? The last case that you mentioned. Why would someone have so many different months where they're out and months where they're back in?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't been able to read the entire order, but my understanding was part of it was to be able to participate in employment, which was the fishing season. So to either fish was part of it. I haven't read the entire.
Okay.
I wanted to see why that was, but it was extensive.
Further questions for Ms. Parks, Secretarial, and Ms.
Parker.
Parker and Parks here.
So, Ms. Parker, did you sort of boil down some suggested language and how a suggestion for how the section should read then to put a limitation? And I think the discussion that I remember from yesterday was we had talked about perhaps drawing the line at 1 year. You know, Senator French has talked about 2, but how. Do you have a suggestion on how that would be
passed? Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes, we did work with staff on language that would read the pre-existing employment reasons that existed prior to sentencing and with a composite sentence of less than 1 year.
Okay. Further questions?
That subject, or are we also?
We're talking primarily. Let's ask about this subject at the moment. Is there anything, any other comments or questions while we're talking about this? Do we have suggested language for this effect that's been printed up yet?
While we're thinking about it, maybe, Mr. Chairman, I can just explain why I selected 2 years.
Go ahead, Senator French.
I guess my concern was with, say, someone who's simply a drug addict, whose only problem in life is that he's a drug addict, and he's been busted with cocaine once and then busted again. Under the old scheme, he'd get on that second bust, he'd get a 2-year sentence flat. He'd get a 2-year presumptive sentence, and away he would go. Assuming no other problems in his life, you know, that's the degree of his criminality. It's wrong, it's bad, he should go to prison. But, you know, if he can get out and hunt for moose to feed his family, get out and fish to keep the family house together, maybe that's appropriate, given, you know, assuming that the judge or the Department of Corrections has looked the entire, you know, fact situation over and come to a decision. So I guess that's, you know, my selection of a 2-year presumptive sentence, a second felony, was, you know, that's the limit. If you get busted for anything more serious than that, it's time for you to just sell the net, sell the rifle, and let the family live on those proceeds while you're away in prison. And when you get out, you can, you know, get a job and buy a rifle and start to hunt again, assuming you're allowed to possess a long rifle. So I guess that's where I was. If Senator Terry wants to argue for a year, I'd certainly entertain that. I think that's not unreasonable. I'm just you know, thinking out loud a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, could
Senator Terry
have a response from the department on 1 year versus 2 as far as
Ms. Parker?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure how much of an impact that would have, simply because since the Felix decision, this has become much less of a problem than it was before that. I think when you get into the 2-year, even a presumptive, they'll be out with good time after serving 2/3. So It's still a problem for us as far as movement of prisoners, having to move prisoners around for population control. And it is a particular problem, again, in the areas where we're always overcrowded, like Bethel and Fairbanks, Matsu Pretrial, some of these other pretrial type facilities, where if we could keep shorter term prisoners there, we would. But as soon as they're sentenced, they're sent someplace else. So it's still problematic, but I don't think it's a big enough issue or big enough problem to make a huge difference as far as our operation.
Okay. Secretary?
Mr. Chairman, then I would move a conceptual amendment to page 2 of the bill, lines 5 through 8, to strike the new suggested language there and replace it with this. But only if an employment obligation of the defendant preexisted sentencing and the defendant receives a composite sentence of less than 2 years to serve.
Is there objection? Hearing none, we'll adopt that.
I guess I have an objection.
Senator Gass, go ahead.
Just for clarification of Secretary, why did you and you decided to take out the clause continuous incarceration would cause extreme hardship, et cetera, et cetera. Is there a reason you took out that clause?
This is just a suggestion that had come back from the drafter.
Okay. We just hadn't discussed that part of it, so I didn't, I just wanted to understand your thinking behind the amendment. I understand the timing of it.
Thank you, Senator Gass. I might comment that, and maybe I'm wrong here, but if I look at that and say, but only if an employment obligation of the defendant pre-existed sentencing, by taking out and continuous incarceration would cause extreme hardship to the defendant's ability to pay fines or restitution, we've actually made it a little bit easier for them to get a periodic sentence. We've removed a degree of difficulty. And we've replaced that with saying that pre-existing employment obligation existed and it was for less than 1 year composite, rather than saying 2 years or whatever. And so I think we've made it a little bit easier to get a composite sentence.
Mr. Chairman, you're right. Before, there was the restriction that it was tied to the person being able to pay restitution,
right,
specifically. That's been removed, but we've replaced it with, you know, the limitation of time. And I guess
well, I could go along with that.
From the testimony from Ms. Parker, that this problem has largely corrected itself, although you've got some pushback from certain judges. That combination plus the new suggested language, I feel comfortable going forward.
I do too, but...
Okay, I removed my objection. I just wanted an explanation of, we had discussed removing that clause. I appreciate it.
You bet. No. So if there's no further objection, that amendment is adopted. Next topic for discussion. Senator Terrio?
I believe we had the issue of the judge granting the parole officer, or probation officer, the right to make the modifications. We just wanted some clarification and perhaps to submit or insert some verbiage here that made it clear that they couldn't just send a letter, because you might have somebody that's illiterate or, you know, doesn't speak English as first language. You want to make sure that somehow the person is contacted and clearly understands the change. And so why don't we have a few comments from Ms. Parker.
Okay, and that's on page 4, I believe.
Page 4, yes. Top of page 4.
Top of page 4. Ms. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Terrio, in discussing this issue with probation officers and our Director of Probation and Parole, they do, both in writing and verbally, speak with the offender. Whenever there's a change, explain it, make sure that they explain the change. So we would not be opposed to adding in writing and verbally. or verbally and in writing, to make sure that that is what's happening now. But we certainly don't oppose adding in verbally as well as in writing.
Mr. Chairman, so I would move conceptual amendment on page 4, line 5, after the word provided, to insert orally and
in writing.
Yes. So it would now say must be provided orally and in writing to the defendant.
That'd be amendment number 2. Is there objection? Any questions on that, Senator Guest?
No, thank you.
I have a question on this topic, but not on this point.
Do you object to this amendment at this point in time? We're going to adopt this amendment, and do you have a question now, Senator French, on this topic?
I do, and I understand there was some discussion yesterday of sort of the parameters of the power of the probation officer to impose conditions of probation, and I guess I just wanted to explore that a little bit more. And the reason I bring that up is because the bill says, you know, if ordered by the court, to abide by additional conditions of probation. It uses that sort of, let's just call it a term of art for right now, conditions of probation. The statute begins on page 3 by saying, while on probation, and among the conditions of probation, the defendant may be required, and it says, to pay a fine, make restitution, provide support, and so forth. I guess what I want to, you know, you to tell me what I already think, which is that the probation officer obviously can't suddenly decide that the defendant has to pay a fine if a fine has not been imposed by the court. And the probation officer can't suddenly decide that the defendant has to make restitution if restitution hasn't been ordered by the court. So I guess I need a little bit more of a definition of where the probation officer has power and where he or she doesn't.
Mr. Chairman, Senator French, that is correct. The probation officer cannot add additional fines or restitution or payments of any kind without going before the court again and adding. If they believe that there is reason for that to be added as a condition, they have to go before the court and request that condition. The typical conditions that a probation officer can add when the court grants them the authority under general condition of probation number 12 is things such as reporting to job type training. If they're not doing well, they're not getting a job, a curfew. If they're finding that the offender can't seek employment because they're staying out till 4 or 5 in the morning and they're not making their appointments, they can set treatment. If they see that the person is having a drug and alcohol problem and they want them to get assessed and get into treatment so that they don't have to revoke them or go again before the court and add for additional conditions. Those kind of things they can add on a temporary basis or on an immediate public safety basis. If they can't get before a court, they need to be able to put those conditions, intermediate sanctions on, so they don't have to revoke and put the person back in jail. So we feel it's critical because it allows our probation officers to actually keep people out of prison and out of jail and also not clog up the court system with every time they need to tweak it, they have to go before the court, which would be a huge burden on our resources and the courts.
And I agree with you completely. And I guess I'm just wondering if that what you just told me is sort of written down somewhere in regulation, in your manual, in your, you know, so that a renegade PO doesn't say, look, it says I can impose conditions of probation, and this says a fine is a condition of probation, and I'm slapping you with a $500 fine. And I know, you know, that's just us talking about it, but you can see my area of concern.
Mr. Chairman, Senator French, I'll have to get that. I do know it is, I don't have it right with me, but we do have it specific about fines and restitution or levying financial obligations on the offender. So I will get that for you.
Further discussion on this topic? Seeing none. Next topic, Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's the only two areas that staff had worked on suggested language changes. I do have a question for Ms. Parks, though.
Ms. Parks? And you both can sit there if you want to, because we might be playing a little ping pong. So
there was a concern expressed yesterday that because we have set the ranges, that a judge wouldn't want to pick the lower end of the range all the time and be potentially labeled as, you know, slack on crime, and therefore we might see an escalation of the sentences that are being handed out. And I'm just wondering if you've thought about that and some way of conveying to the court system that the way the bill has been structured is not meant to lead the court in that direction, whether it be addition of some findings, although I'm generally one that likes to strip findings out of bills. I don't feel like a lot of that verbiage belongs in the statutes, but perhaps a letter of intent that the judiciary could refer back to or could be brought to their attention. So I'm just wondering your comments on that.
The Chair, Senator Terrio, I have thought about that quite a bit, and it certainly is speculation, you know, on how this bill is going to be implemented. You know, Ms. Brink shared her concerns yesterday. I have my views, but it is speculation. Until the bill goes into effect, we aren't going to know exactly. I do think a letter of intent would be a good way to make clear what the purpose of the implementation of the bill is, and that it is not the intent of the legislature to across the board raise sentences unless you make that conscious decision in looking at the ranges and say, we think these are too low, we do want to raise these. But simply by creating this new system, really the intent is to bring our current system of sentencing into compliance with Blakely, not to raise sentences. You know, just anecdotally, I guess, in doing some research on this, I did run across a case, Belts v. State. It was a sentence appeal where a defendant had sexually abused his 11-year-old daughter. He was convicted of SAM in the first degree. The presumptive was an 8-year sentence. He appealed it as being too harsh, and in doing so, he quoted the Superior Court judge at his sentencing, who stated on the record that if it were not for the legislature ordering an 8-year presumptive, half the judges in the state would only give 5 years for this type of offense. Now, this is anecdotal evidence, but it's been my experience that one of the reasons presumptive sentencings were implemented, and one of the reasons judges in general don't like them, is that sometimes they believe they're too harsh. So I don't share that concern, but I think a letter of intent would certainly make your intentions clear.
Okay. And then also we had some testimony yesterday about the number of cases that that potentially, if you had to actually litigate the aggravators, the number of cases that actually where aggregators kick in. And I'm wondering if you track down some data on that. And also a question I think I posed to the committee yesterday is how many cases do mitigators come into impact the sentence?
The Chair, Senator Terrio, I did try to track that down. I think Ms. Brink in her testimony talked about 120 cases that were aggravated. And that may be accurate. What I wanted to find out is how many cases aggravators were actually proposed, and that's a very different number. So I actually called Terry Carnes at the Judicial Council. She was one of the people involved in this 1999 felony study, and asked her how many cases did the state notice aggravating factors. They only looked at two-thirds of the felony cases for 1999, and notice of aggravators were filed in 483 cases. Now that would extrapolate out, if you looked at 100%, to 642 cases, where the state, again, it's up to the judge to decide whether to increase the sentence or not, but as the state, we're going to allege them when we feel they're appropriate. So potentially we're looking at 642 cases where the state would be proposing aggravators, potentially taking them to a trial jury. I asked her about mitigators as well. She said that in the cases they looked at, in 186 cases, mitigators were noticed up. And again, that would extrapolate out to 247 cases where mitigators were noticed up. I think it's important to note our felony caseload referrals, that was 1999, has increased by roughly 1,000 cases since 1999, so I think we're looking at even a higher number of cases where potentially aggravators and mitigators would apply. In the 1999 study, they do a pie chart just looking at how many cases actually do get aggravated, how many get mitigated, and roughly all offenses combined, because it's different for B and C felonies, but overall 55% of the cases that the person got the presumptive sentence, in 25% they got below the presumptive, a mitigated sentence, and in 20% they got above. So just to give you a little additional information.
And so you said roughly 1,000 additional cases. Is that a 20% increase? What was the total?
The total, in 1999, there were 5,629 new felony referrals. And in 2003, we had 6,477. So that's about a 15% increase, I think. My math is fairly accurate. So I think it's a significant, again, in looking at the bill, part of it is a resource question. And I think in looking at the bill, particularly Ms. Brink testified about how she thought that aggravators should go to a grand jury, that would be a significant resource problem for the state and for the criminal justice system as a whole. That's grand jury time, that's attorney time. And I believe Senator Seekins asked the question, well, what if the state doesn't know about aggravators early on? What happens when they come to our attention? Well, what happens is we have to go back to grand jury. And it's just, I think it's extremely unrealistic to expect the state to have that kind of information that early in the process.
Thank you.
Senator French.
On that topic of notice of aggravators, this is on page 17 of the bill. And I just had some question about the phrasing of the time parameters for giving notice to the other side about aggravators. On lines 26 through 31, it talks about 10 days before trial or at another time specified, 28 within 48 hours or at a time specified, and so forth. Is it, by the use of that phrase, is it anyone thinking that it might be less than 10 days that you might be able to walk in on the day of trial and say, oh, we're filing these aggravators? Or are you just trying to give the judge some leeway, or what's the thinking there?
Senator French, through the chair, I think it's to give some leeway. I can see courts going both ways. I can see there's often a lot of local practice depending on the court. I can see some courts in their pretrial orders thinking 20 days or 30 days was more appropriate and making it longer. I think that in a issue of fairness, if the state suddenly gets information 5 days before trial perhaps that's significant, a court might let us have less than 10 days, say you can give notice less than 10 days before trial. The remedy would be a continuance for the defense. But I think it is to give leeway for those kinds of situations that inevitably come up.
And that's for trial. I actually have questions about lesser includes and changes of plea. Just, I guess, so we can just all understand, walk me through how it worked for a lesser included. You know, you're charged with assault in the first degree. Suddenly the jury looks like they might be convicting on something less, assault in the second. How would an aggravator suddenly be sort of new news for assault two that wasn't, you know, contemplated in the assault one trial?
Certainly. Senator French, through the chair, this actually was inserted there because it happened in a case. This is a real-life situation. We had a trial. It was actually a retrial where the defendant was charged with murder in the second degree. Murder in the second degree does not have a presumptive sentence. Therefore, aggravators, mitigators are not applicable. So the state hadn't gone to grand jury on aggravators, hadn't noticed up any aggravators. We had not indicted on manslaughter, which is the lesser included. We go to trial. At trial, the defense asks for the lesser included of manslaughter. The jury is instructed on manslaughter, and they come back with a guilty plea of manslaughter, not guilty on murder in the second degree. Manslaughter has a presumptive. Aggravators do apply to manslaughter. And we requested at that point to notice up some aggravators and ask the jury to find aggravators, and the judge refused. The Superior Court judge in that case This is one of our conflicting orders that we're getting with this problem, stated that the state has to take aggravators to the grand jury. We hadn't taken them to the grand jury, therefore we were precluded from bringing them into the trial. So we're appealing that ruling, but that's the kind of real-life situation that this could come up in.
Thank you. Just finally, on changes of plea, it seems like a change of plea is when you just agree to plead to a charge, you go into court, you're going to get sentenced now, and typically it's open sentencing. You get a reduction in the charge, and then you agree to go open sentencing. So you're going to have this range of aggravators that may apply to your sentence and make it bigger. What I'm curious is what happens if the defendants, you know, balks, won't admit the aggravators, and you have a contest on those? They may be an aggravator that says it's the most serious within its class of offense. It's not something that the judge can just look at his file and find by clear and convincing evidence. It's something that the statute now is going to say a jury has to find. And what happens? I mean, I just need to know what you're thinking is on that.
Sure. Senator French, through the chair, again, this is a real-life situation that has come up for us given the Blakely ruling. We are requesting a jury trial on aggravators alone. We're asking the court, and we would ask in this situation, certainly we would try to negotiate that as part of a plea. We want to avoid those kinds of situations. But we had the situation arise where someone had entered a change of plea prior to the Blakely decision coming down. We're pending sentencing. We think we're going to be able to have the judge make findings on aggravators. The Blakely decision comes down. The judge can't make those findings. We requested a jury trial. And so that is what we would do in this situation, although we would work to avoid that.
Senator Terrio.
In that fact pattern, you had the decision came down during the process. But now that we all know what the new lay of the land is, I guess that was that... They just accepted a plea, or they just changed and pled guilty? There was no negotiation? Because certainly you would be able to, if you were into a negotiation situation, you would be able to negotiate the full sentence and whether it should or shouldn't have an aggravator.
Senator Terror, through the chair, absolutely. It's because of the timing, and normally we would have gotten either a stipulation that the aggravators existed, an agreement that we wouldn't pursue aggravators, or simply an agreed upon sentence. So we would strive to avoid this kind of situation. There may be the rare case where we believe the aggravators are simple to prove. We want to prove them because of the person's willing to plead, won't stipulate to aggravators. We're willing to do the work because of the nature of the offense or the offender. And that would be how we would proceed.
Thank you. Ms. Parks, is your intent in this bill, the way that you're presenting it and working on it with us, that aggravators not be required to go to the grand jury, but that they could be detected at a later time and still be added into the jury trial? Is that correct?
Absolutely. Under the rules, if someone's in custody, once they're arrested, if they're in custody, unless they waive time, we only have 10 days to get to grand jury. And so 10 days is a very short period. You often, especially in a very serious case, don't have all your police reports, don't have all your background information. Often, under our current system, we relied on the pre-sentence report to give us a lot of information that we relied on for aggravators. And that's why under our current system, aggravators are noticed 10 days before sentencing. We're not going to have that luxury anymore, but 10 days after arrest is just simply not enough time for us to know all the facts.
So aggravators are still in place on certain crimes in the state of Alaska after Blakely, but that the standard of proof is now changed, and it has to be found by a jury rather than by the judge. And the standard of proof now is?
Beyond a reasonable doubt.
Beyond a reasonable doubt, rather than just clear and convincing evidence to a judge. I don't see in this draft, the way that it has been presented by the sponsor, that it is the intent of the sponsor that aggravators need to go to a grand jury. And I have not seen any amendment to the bill that would indicate that that's the intent of the committee or any of the members of the committee. Certainly they're willing to do so, but based on that at this point in time, it would appear to me that that's not the intent of this legislation, that we require aggravators to go to a grand jury. And if there's any objection or any discussion on that fact, it would be, I'm open to that at this point in time. Senator French?
I agree with Ms. Parks. I mean, the ballistics evidence, the forensics evidence, the DNA evidence, none of that's available 10 days later. And so there's just no way you can know everything you need to know. It may be out of an abundance of caution that you decide from time to time if you've got an obvious case that you present to a grand jury. But I think it's got to be within the discretion of the DA's office.
So I think that the record needs to be very clear at this point that it is not the intent of this bill or the legislature to require aggravators be presented to a grand jury. Then let's go on. Next topic of discussion. Senator Guest, did I hear you cough or clear your throat?
I did have a follow-up question on something that Senator Tirio had asked.
Please go right ahead.
Thank you. On the increase in sentences, Ms. Parks, I guess I'm still confused. I'm still trying to read up and understand Blakely. I understand that the aggravators have to go to a jury trial. How does the range, providing ranges in the bill, does Blakely force us to provide ranges in the bill, or is we chosen to put ranges in the bill?
Senator Guest, through the chair, no, Blakely does not require ranges. This is one option, and the option that we believe is appropriate for Alaska. A response to Blakely could be wide open sentencing, going back to giving judges full discretion of, you know, 0 to 10, 0 to 5. The purpose of the ranges is to recognize that the playing field has changed. Our sentencing scheme was put into effect really giving judges a lot of discretion. They got to find aggravators by clear and convincing evidence. They got to decide how to implement them. That's been taken away, and our presumptive sentences were set up with the view and with the system that judges could make those findings on that lower burden of proof. Now that that's been upped, now that juries have to find it, now that additional resources have to be used, we think that giving judges some ranges gives them back some of that discretion that Blakely took away, but still complying with the constitutional mandates. If you're going to go above these ranges, a jury will find the aggravators. And in fact, the ranges, you know, without aggravators, right now, if a judge finds even one aggravator, that gives the judge the discretion to go to the max. These ranges aren't, most of them, except on the far end with two prior felonies, don't allow the judge to go to the max, so actually restricts them more than the finding of one aggravator does. So we think it brings back balance into the system.
Thank you, and I'll just follow up with one question so I understand what you said. Can you just go over how a judge would determine where in the range that they should fall? You had just mentioned it, that they couldn't get to the maximum range.
Right. Well, when a judge is faced with sentencing someone, under Title 12, there's what's called a Declaration of Purpose, 1255-005, and it is basically the principles of sentencing that judges are supposed to look at whenever they sentence someone. And it would be, we would anticipate that judges would look to those principles to determine where in the range someone would fall. And just briefly, the declaration purpose, it says the legislature finds that the elimination of unjustified disparity in sentences and the attainment of reasonable uniformity in sentences can best be achieved through a sentencing framework set by statute, imposing sentence the court should consider, and these are things the legislature has set out. Seriousness of the defendant's present offense in relation to other offenses, prior criminal history, likelihood of rehabilitation, need to confine the defendant, circumstances of the offense, harm to the victim, effect of the sentence to be imposed in deterring the defendant and deterring others, and community condemnation, restoration of the victim. So those principles are what a judge would look at in deciding where in the range an appropriate sentence would be.
Okay, thank you. And I just have one other question, Mr. Chairman.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. And it might be to the sponsor or to Ms. Parks about the discussion yesterday about the inconsistency that we've had in the past and trying to not have inconsistent sentences. How are we going to ensure in the future that we're not going back to a situation where we have very inconsistent sentences? You know, given now that we're in a range, we have very inconsistent sentences for the same type of situations.
Senator Guest, through the chair, most states that I've looked at that have presumptive sentencing schemes actually have ranges, and in fact, I have the Washington ranges here. I've looked at Kansas, which Ms. Brink referenced yesterday. Kansas has ranges. Many of the states already have ranges, presumptive ranges, and they've found that even with the ranges, it took care of the disparity problems in those states. We believe that with fairly narrow ranges, and it obviously the legislature will look at these ranges and decide how narrow or wide they want them, that we will still, you know, take care of the disparity problem because the judges will still have direction by the presumptive sentencing scheme.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Guest. Senator French.
I guess I'd like to weigh in on the range idea, and I think it is a good idea, and I guess I'd like to offer a quick little story about a case I handled that explains why I think it's a good idea. It was an A felony assault case, and if you look at that column under A felonies, you'll see that under the old scheme, the presumptive sentencing was 5 years, and it was a really serious assault case that for 18 and 19-year-olds inflicted on a 14-year-old boy in the Valley in Moon Park in Anchorage, and over a taunt, this 14-year-old had taunted these older boys. They stomped him into something that no one could recognize. When he went to the hospital, they didn't know who it was for several days because he was so badly beaten, and he's got permanent brain injuries as a result. The case was negotiated by a senior felony attorney at the office, and the negotiation was that all four defendants had to plead to assault in the first degree, open sentencing. And then it was handed off to me for sentencing. And I looked through the file, and I saw some aggravators. I thought some aggravators applied. I submitted, I think, four aggravators to the court, and the court declined to find any of those aggravators. And once that happened, the sentence was set. We all knew, you know, an hour into the sentencing exactly what was going to happen. We still had two more hours to go, but it was going to be 5 years flat for each one of these 18 to 19-year-old young men. That was very disturbing to me on a couple of levels. I thought he should have found the aggravators, but more importantly, these guys got 5 years flat. When they came out of prison at 22 and 23, they'd just done some serious hard time. They weren't going to get probation. They didn't get any suspended time. There was no probation officer to look after them for the next 2 or 3 years to try to get them squared away a little bit. They were just going to be released from prison on parole, essentially, and that was it. And I think this range would help a lot. You could now give these, even without an aggravator, you can give them 8 years with three suspended, five to serve, exact same sentence, but now they come out with a little bit of guidance about job, rehabilitation for their drug problems, whatever it is that they've got going on. So I think it's a good tool for both the DA's office and the judge to have a little bit of room to work with.
Senator Terrell.
Mr. Chairman,
my staff has brought to my attention Section 5, there may be a wording problem, and I think Ms. Parks might have a statement on that. You know, might need to clean up a little language there.
That's correct. This is on page 3, Section 5, and actually, Senator Seekins, this may have been a problem that you caught early on in the bill that I think did not get corrected. And
I was going to mention that later.
I believe that it should read on line 14, sentence or lower than the presumptive range. I think it reads exactly opposite.
This would have made it impossible for us to do anything.
So I do believe that an amendment needs to be made to correct that.
Senator Tail.
Mr. Chairman, I would move an amendment, conceptual amendment, on page 3, line 14, after the word or, strike within and replace it then with lower than.
Is there objection? Hearing none, amendment number 3 is adopted. And glad to see your staff caught that too. I was reading through that and I thought for 10 minutes I kept reading that and thinking, is my mind just not working here or is something wrong? But the Ms. Parks, I would like you to I don't recall that we gave you an opportunity to respond to the comments that were made by Ms. Brink regarding the lower limit to the presumptive sentences, that she felt that we were just increasing the upper limit, but we weren't addressing the lower limit. I assume that was meant just that she felt that there would, just like there could be aggravating factors that would cause a judge to try to go to the upper limit, that there could be mitigating factors that could cause the judge to go to a lower limit. And I wonder if you might just address that for us.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The bill is drafted starting the ranges, except for two instances, at the current presumptive. And the thought behind that was simply mitigation hasn't changed. The Blakely decision did not affect a judge's ability to find mitigators by clear and convincing evidence and to mitigate accordingly. And so because Blakely only affected the judge's ability to aggravate, we felt that that was the appropriate place to start the range. Obviously, the legislature can take a look at these ranges and make changes if you feel it's appropriate, but Blakely did not affect the current system's ability to mitigate sentences.
With that explanation on the record, I don't have any objection to leaving it the way it is myself, a lot of the members of the committee as well, but I think our intent with that explanation is that mitigating factors have not been affected, so therefore there is not any perceived need to build mitigating factors into the presumptive sentence scheme. Is there any objection to that or any discussion on that? Okay, thank you. Other questions?
Just briefly.
Senator French.
Last week the Supreme Court issued a ruling in a case called Booker, and there was a companion case called Fanfan. And in that rather splintered, confusing welter of opinions, did you see anything that affects Blakely or your statutory fix here? I mean, it looked to me like it was all about the federal sentencing guidelines and sort of putting them under the Blakely decision, but maybe you read it or someone in your department's read it more carefully.
Senator French, the chair, yes, we've had our appellate attorneys looking at it and reviewing it, and we don't believe that it affects the response that's proposed in this bill. It really was fairly specific to the federal guidelines, turned them into to voluntary guidelines. It's a very different system than what we've got, and we don't believe this bill is affected by those decisions.
And just one more small point.
Go ahead.
And this is a narrow point, but you know, Blakely, that what I got out of Blakely was, other than the fact of a prior conviction, any fact that increases the penalty has to be proved beyond reasonable doubt to a jury. And in this bill, we've exempted, you know, a half a dozen, I guess, facts that I guess could be characterized as facts that a judge can learn by looking at his own file or looking at the court's own file. You can go to the court's own file and see this fact, and we don't have to submit it to a jury. We're going to leave it to the judge. And I guess the only one that I think there might be some tiny quibbling on, so I guess I just want to get your reasoning on the record, is number 12. It's on page 12, line 27. It's not a fact of a prior conviction. It's whether the defendant is on release, bail release. for a charge having assault as an element. Another felony or conviction, any felony or assault having assault as an element, misdemeanors having assault as an element. Can you explain how you decided to include that and why?
Certainly, Senator French, through the chair. Again, we felt like this was one that the judge could basically take judicial notice of. Again, looking at a file, looking at what the charge is, this was something that the judge could determine based on looking at the court file. And so we thought it was appropriate to be included as one that didn't have to go through a jury.
It's black and white.
That's how we saw it.
Okay. Ms. Parks, I wonder if you could maybe turn to page 23 and we could look at section 29. A consideration, and again, I'm not trying to be redundant here, but a consideration expressed by our drafters that we should discuss is that it could be argued that section 29 constitutes an impermissible change in sentence, an unconstitutional increase in punishment when applied to offenses committed before the effective date of the act. By allowing the Board of Parole to make a prisoner ineligible for further consideration of parole when they otherwise would have been eligible appears to be an increase in punishment. And you should, his advice to us is that we should closely examine this provision and its application to offenses committed before the effective date of the act. I wonder if you would comment on the record for us on that.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, discretionary parole is exactly that. It's discretionary. No one's entitled to it. And so, starting with that premise, you're not entitled to discretionary parole, so being denied it, you're not being denied or your sentence isn't being changed, you shouldn't have an expectation you're going to get it. It's my understanding that what this is intended to do is to not say someone can. My understanding of this is they can ask for discretionary parole the first time, but if the board decides, you know, this is someone based on their history and what we know of them, we know we're not going to release them, they just don't meet our criteria, should the parole board be required to have a hearing again and again and again with this same person? And all this is intended to do is to cut down on the parole board expending resources, having discretionary hearings, when they've made a determination that this person doesn't meet their standards. And so, again, I think because it's discretionary parole and not something someone's entitled to or should have an expectation that they're going to get, I don't believe it can be seen as a sentence modification.
Okay. I wanted to have that discussion on the record so that we understood exactly what was being done here. Ms. Parker, maybe you could tell us just briefly, if you'd come up and join Ms. Parks. What standards would you be looking at that would disqualify someone from this discretionary parole hearing?
Mr. Chairman, Portia Parker, for the record again, considerations that the parole board looks at conduct while incarcerated, have they availed themselves of opportunities for reform or treatment, their past conduct, convictions, they look at a whole wide array of considerations while they're considering a discretionary parole. And they're very cautious, they're very careful about what they grant under their discretion. So they are doing this already. This is current practice in their regulations, that once they deny someone, sometimes they'll say you can reapply for discretionary in 6 months or a year or 2 years, depending on how much time they have left to serve. And this is just making it very clear in that they have the authority to do what they're already doing under regulation. And I think the reason that this is needed is more preventative, because we continue to have challenges to this, although it's my understanding they have not been successful.
Well, you could say a crime committed while incarcerated could maybe be cause someone not to be able to have another for any further discretionary parole hearing or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, that could be one of the reasons.
One of the reasons, yeah. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we discussed that topic on the record. I'd like us to look then at Section 7 on page 4. And Ms. Parks, maybe you can, for the record, look at the question I think that was brought up by Ms. Brink yesterday on line 13. Her concern, if I remember correctly, I'm paraphrasing it, is that an appellate court would no longer be able to say that a sentence was excessive and reverse that. Am I correct in paraphrasing her concern?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. My recollection is that Senator Terrio asked her if she felt this bill met the constitutional requirements of Blakely. I think she agreed that it did. The one concern she had was the Section 7 having to do with appellate rights. She was concerned that it was unconstitutional. And I went back and researched that issue, and the Department of Law strenuously disagrees with that analysis. What the purpose of this subsection is, this does not deny someone the right to appeal their sentence for things like procedural problems, evidence that should have come in that didn't, evidence that came in that shouldn't have, any kind of substantive problem. What this provision says, though, is the legislature has set a range of sentence that is appropriate for this offense, for example, A felonies, if you set it from 5 to 8. If you receive a sentence within that range, you don't get to appeal it. A court can't reverse it, saying it's excessive. The legislature, you know, under the law, under the case law, under statutory law, the legislature gets to set appropriate sentences. And what we've seen over the years is the Court of Appeals more and more trying to set sentencing law. And this is really to sort of pull back on that. I've looked at the case law. There's a Supreme Court case, Bear v. State. It's an old case, 1968, that basically said the Supreme Court didn't even have the authority to review sentences at all. And this was back in the day when there was wide open sentencing for excessiveness. In response to that, the legislature gave statutory authority to the Supreme Court to look at sentences. The legislature created the Court of Appeals and gave them statutory authority to look at sentences. But if you look at cases that have come since then, you look at the Razakdal case. This is a 1997 Court of Appeals case. Bear is again cited as good law. And what Razakdal was about is the legislature at one point, I think in 1995, passed a statute restricting sentence appeals for people who received sentences to serve of less than 2 years. And there was a challenge to that. You know, you couldn't appeal your sentence as excessive. There was a challenge to that, and the Court of Appeals says, no, the legislature had good solid reasons for doing that. In fact, they cite resource issues of wanting to restrict the resources of the Court of Appeals, the Public Defender, Department of Law, and given the especially the shortness of the sentences, to say those can't be appealed on the basis of being excessive, that's within the legislature's province. You set sentences, you get to set sentencing law. So we do not believe this is unconstitutional. We do believe it's within the legislature's authority. And because we're going to ranges now, and this discussion we've had of, you know, where in the range is someone going to go, we would anticipate that people who maybe get near the top of the range or even the middle of the range may try to challenge that just on the basis of, well, before I would have gotten 8, this is excessive. To sort of give support to the ranges and give the support to the judges, they shouldn't have to be second-guessed if they are within the range the legislature has said is an appropriate range of sentencing. So that's what Section 7 is set out to do. We do believe it's constitutional, and I'd urge you to leave it in.
Is there a discussion on this topic, Senator Tillio?
Mr. Chairman, in particular, because we've asked that the ranges be drawn fairly narrowly. You know, it's not a huge, expansive number of years. So that, I think, just bolsters the argument that the ranges have been crafted reasonably, and so if you fall in that range, we are just making a determination that is reasonable, and we're declaring that it's not subject to questioning.
Thank you. Any further comments? Senator Guest, any questions, comments at this point?
No, thank you.
I just want to continue to try not to forget that you're there, Senator Guest.
I appreciate it.
Senator Huggins.
Mr. Chair, if I might, this is my first opportunity to sit through a hearing of such on the committee, and I'd just like to, number one, pass on my compliments to all the players, but particularly the two that are sitting before us today, because, number one, it's been educational for me, but equally important, I think, for the people of Alaska to realize that quality people representing their interest, that's important for all of us to realize. It's heartening for me to be able to witness that firsthand, and I say thank you very much for all the players that have helped us to this point through the system, and my compliments.
Thank you. With that, we're going to take a 5-minute recess. Be back in 5 minutes. We're back on the record. Further questions or discussion from members of the committee? I know Senator French will be right back in, and we'll make sure he gets to do it. He's in the lounge at the moment, I think. Just tipping off staff where to find him. Here he comes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terrio.
I think we perhaps have dealt with all the issues today. Of course, there were the three conceptual amendments, and I would propose that we not take any final action until we see those changes actually on the printed page, make sure that there wasn't any wordsmithing, that suggestions from our drafters. And also would like to work with Ms. Parks on the letter of intent. So it would be my intent between today and tomorrow's meeting to have letter of intent worked out, and hopefully have enough time to shut down all members so they get a chance to look at it before being asked to vote on it. In addition, we are hoping to iron out with all the different departments potential fiscal impact. It's my suspicion that we'll be able to get zero fiscal notes from all the departments, which may negate the necessity of taking the bill to the Finance Committee. So I'd like to just have the rest of the today to try and work that out before the committee takes final action.
Okay. Let me take a look at who else we might have that wanted to put any testimony into the bill today. I do have Sydney Billingsley from Anchorage with the Trial Lawyers Association. Ms. Billingsley, are you still there?
I'm here, Chairman.
Would you put yourself on the record, and we'd be eager to hear your testimony this morning.
Thank you, sir. My name is Sydney Billingsley. I'm here in Anchorage. I'm testifying as one of the members and board of director of the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers. And at the outset of this bill, I will confess that I'm relatively new to the legislation, so these thoughts are my initial thoughts, and I hope to augment them as I get further into my study of it. But these are my initial impressions, sir. I think that the cases Blakely and Booker and Fanfan were decided by the Supreme Court, and mindfully a conservative Supreme Court, to be pro-constitutional rights of the accused. And they were decided primarily to support and uphold the Sixth Amendment right to jury trial, especially on aggravating factors, and also to reduce prosecutorial power, which was essentially, as the federal sentencing guidelines were applied, to withhold relevant collateral information until the imposition of sentence, and then permit enormous increases in guideline sentences, and restrict judges' discretion not to give those enormous increases based on relevant conduct. For example, a jury trial on 50 grams of crack cocaine became a sentence on 500 grams of crack cocaine, and an expected sentencing guideline sentence of 7 to 8 years became a sentence of 20 to 30 years. So the purposes of Blakely and Booker were not to increase the sentences of people who were accused, and rather they have the effect of decreasing those guideline sentences. So I respectfully disagree with Ms. Parks when she says the intent of this bill is to address Blakely and not to increase sentences, because that is essentially exactly what it does. If the SB 56 seizes an opportunity that gives free proof by preponderance of evidence aggravators to prosecutors by giving a sentencing range of 8 to 12 years, for example, on a unclassified sex offense. Prior to this suggested bill, if there were no aggravating factors and no mitigating factors, an individual would get an 8-year presumptive sentence. Now, an individual can get an unreviewable 8 to 12-year sentence, which has the practical effect of giving the prosecutors a free aggravator or two. It does not give, however, the defense a free mitigator or two, because the defense has to prove its mitigators by clear and convincing evidence, not by a preponderance of evidence. It's one of the things that the Booker case, Booker and Fanfan case, does is addresses pretty carefully what congressional intent was in drafting the sentencing guidelines. And I would ask this body to look at the legislative intent in presumptive sentencing. I take, again, as an example, because it's particularly effective, I think, in the unclassified sex offense category. One of the legislative purposes to increasing the original suggested presumptive term for a first-degree sexual assault was so that an individual could receive and complete sex offender treatment while incarcerated. That is no longer an option, as we all know, for those who have been convicted of committing sex offenses. So the question is, was it in fact your intent to continue to have an 8-year sentence and in fact increase the possibility of it being 12 years when the purpose of having an 8-year sentence in the first place no longer exists? So I ask you to examine that from an historical perspective as well as a practical perspective. To address Senator French's concern that people who are accused, like in his example, and convicted of committing sentences and getting a mere 5 years, and I ask you all to reflect on what you were doing 5 years ago and 4 years ago, three and so on, and how much time that actually is. There is mandatory parole of 1/3 of a sentence. So in his example of they only got 5 years as 18-year-old offenders, there were 20 months on the street under the supervision of a parole or probation officer. When an individual is on parole and probation, as you now know and have been educated about, they're supervised, and there is no court access, essentially no court access. If an individual violates conditions of parole, he may be immediately incarcerated without judicial review and subject to the parole board's discretion. If a person is released on discretionary parole, the period of supervision increases by 1/3 again. So 2/3 of an individual's discretionary parole time would be well supervised. So the longer the sentence, the longer the supervision without the need for suspended time and probation, because essentially the mandatory parole time is your suspended jail time. So I think that possibly addresses that concern and at least decreases the concern. I see this as opportunism, if you will, to increase sentences, and I don't see it as any other way. The sentencing ranges, for example, could have been 6 to 12 years or 6 to 10 years, not 8 to 12 years. So these numbers did not come with an eye toward completely preserving judicial discretion. In fact, judicial discretion is not increased, it's decreased by having these sentencing ranges. Before, a judge could go from, if an aggravator was found, they could go all the way up to the maximum penalty. Now they can go for free up to the top of the range, and then if it's proved beyond a reasonable doubt, or they could go all the way up to the maximum penalty. So those are my initial thoughts to the committee. And I'm sure I'll be back with some more thoughts on this bill as time goes on.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, I do have one question, Ms.
Yes,
Billingsley.
Sir.
Can you provide us with any citation of a decision which provides that the ranges are not constitutional?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that constitutionality of sentencing ranges isn't the issue here.
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that we didn't have anything raised there. Okay, any other further questions? Any further discussion by members of the committee? I think we have gone through everyone that wanted to testify on 56 at this time. Hearing no further... is there someone else online that wished to testify?
I'm online. My name is William Oberle.
Okay, Bill. I see you, I had you signed up for Senate Bill 19. Did you want to testify on this?
I actually wanted to testify on both, so...
Okay. Go ahead, sir, if you'll put yourself on the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Phil Oberle. I'm president of the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers. However, our group has not had an opportunity to review this legislation and make a prepare comments as a group. So these are basically my personal comments. As a student of history, I have learned that reactive legislation requires the greatest reflection. And as has been put on record, this legislation is reactive to the Blakely decision from the Supreme Court. And I note that reactive legislation requires the greatest reflection in this case because the fallout of Blakely really hasn't been fully felt yet. As noted, the Supreme Court came down with a second decision interpreting parts of its Blakely decision in Booker Fanfan just last week. So I think we have to tread very carefully in this area until we really know what we're looking at. I note that the committee has felt that there's going to be a zero fiscal impact from this legislation, and I really don't believe that in the long run that is what is going to happen here. I don't know if there are going to be more trials or not because of the increased penalty possibilities. That's always a possibility, but I don't think that's where we need to look. I think we need to look on the increased costs to the Department of Corrections. I don't think there's going to be any doubt that because it will be easier for a judge to increase a sentence, there are going to be increased sentences. And the Department of Corrections is going to feel the impact. So I see this not as a resource issue, as Ms. Parks has commented, that the Department of Law saves money because they don't have to present aggravators to the grand jury. They save attorney time. I see this as a resource transfer from the Department of Law to the Department of Corrections. But I also see this as contrary to the underpinnings of the original presumptive sentencing scheme. I know Ms. Parks has said that, well, in Washington and in Kansas, they have presumptive sentencing ranges, and it works. The presumptive sentencing scheme was was made law in the state of Alaska for a very specific reason, and that is because there were disparate sentences on similar criminal facts in various parts of the state. So the legislature said the solution to this is to impose presumptive sentencing. That is, as Mr. Rankus said in his opinion piece today in the Daily News, that it is presumed that that sentence is appropriate unless there are changes or unless there are specific factual situations as set forth in the legislation that would modify that sentence. What this legislation does is now take that presumption out and again allow for disparate sentences. And not disparate sentences lower than the presumed sentence, but now disparate sentences that are above the presumed sentence with no additional findings required from the court. I did not hear, either in testimony or out in the public, a clamoring for higher sentences for the crimes that are set out in the criminal statutes. But that is, in fact, what this legislation does. I mentioned that the Alaska trial lawyers haven't reached a consensus on this legislation, and part of that is that we were not involved in the process. I don't know if the chairman and the members of the committee know that we are the affiliate for the for NACDL, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. We represent much of the private criminal defense bar, and we would like to be involved when these type of issues are being addressed by the legislature. We weren't, so that's why Ms. Billingsley and I came and have offered this testimony. But again, I think the legislature has to tread very carefully in how it reacts to Blakely, especially given what I feel is going to be a significant fiscal impact of this legislation. And as Ms. Billingsley indicated, as this legislation proceeds, I think our group will keep a close eye on it and hopefully be able to provide the committee and the legislature with additional information and comments.
Thank you. Any questions? Hearing none, we're going to hold this bill over till tomorrow, allow the sponsor to get a clean draft, including the amendments, the three amendments that we've approved today. And I anticipate that we'll bring this bill for final action tomorrow. With that, let's turn to item number 2, Senate Bill 19. Have Mr. Michel here to present Senate Bill 19 to us this morning. Welcome to the Judiciary Committee, Mr. Michel.
Yes, sir. Good morning.
If you'll put yourself on the record, we're eager to hear your testimony this morning.
My name is Joe Michel. I'm a legislative aide to Senator Ralph Seekins. The bill that I'm speaking to is Senate Bill 19, an act related to the creation of a civil legal services fund. It is an addition to the Alaska Statute, Chapter 37, 05-146, which is an area discussing the definition of program receipts and non-general fund program receipts. My report will be pretty short. This bill is less than 100 words long. This bill is designed to provide a financial mechanism whereby the legislature may make appropriations to organizations that provide civil legal services to low-income Alaskans. This would be accomplished through the creation of a civil legal services account funded by provisions required under Alaska Statute Chapter 9, 17020J. It's the section of the Alaska law that requires 50% of all punitive damage awards to be turned over to the state and deposited into the general fund. The civil legal needs of economically disadvantaged Alaskans are generally no different than anybody else's. Family law, health, wills, and probate issues know no socioeconomic boundaries. Yet when these needs arise, self-represented litigants quite often find themselves unable to effectively represent their interests. These situations are often placed in front of the judge, who have the inappropriate position of offering legal advice or even mediating between these two parties. The inherent logic of the proposed legislation lies in the fact that the funds utilized to assist the disadvantaged in civil legal matters flow out of the civil legal system itself. So high-stakes civil cases provide the funding mechanism for smaller but no less important cases impacting low-income Alaskans. Thank you very much. I'll entertain any questions that the committee may have right now.
Questions for members of the committee? For everyone's...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Guess.
Thank you. I had a question about the definition that you used for low income and whether or not that's going to constrain organizations who provide services to maybe people that are 125% of poverty. And just how did you decide on the definition of low income individual?
That was what was suggested to me by the civil legal services people.
Okay. I don't know what the guidelines are now, so I just, that's why I was asking.
Yeah, and Andy Harrington is here, and we'll ask, I think he's online somewhere. Andy, are you there?
Yes, Senator, I'm here in Fairbanks, thank you.
We'll get into this. We'll get into this, Senator Guest, but it was the suggestion of the people in the civil services folks.
Great.
Any other questions for the presenter at the moment? Senator French.
Yeah. Only question I have is about the windfall we can expect to reap from this bill. Does anybody have any idea if it's tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, any idea what we can hope to get?
It could be anywhere from zero to large numbers. It's kind of a roll of the dice here to speak, but it's an opportunity. I think, if I remember correctly, the number, and I'll have to ask again, but I think last year it would have been around a little over $100,000 that one might have been available. Senator Theriault.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I stepped out for a second, talked to agency personnel. Where is this windfall coming from?
Let's get Art Peterson up here. Art, would you come up and put yourself on the record? Thank you, Mr. Michel. And Art is with the Alaska Legal Services Corporation and probably has spun up on this bill as anybody in the state. Is that correct, Art?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, pretty much correct. I think Andy Harrington up there in the sky can provide even better information, but I'll make a few comments.
And then we'll get to Andy right after you.
Okay. I'm Art Peterson, a recently retired attorney here in Juneau. I am about to conclude 31 years on the board of Alaska Legal Services. Four of those were as an alternate member, but the other 27 as a regular member. And this will be my final term. The bill before you fits a funding source into the legislative pattern that was established, I think, in the mid-80s, early 80s, something like that. You can see that this is paragraph 78, specifically identifying this fund. The source is the punitive damages. The source of the money is the punitive damages. Fluctuates wildly. I don't know any specific number. I think the chair's comment a little bit earlier about last year around 100,000 is a number that I've heard. Perhaps others can give more specific information. Alaska Legal Services is approaching 40 years in existence, and one of the points that I always make about it as a board member, so it's not self-laudatory, is I laud the staff because those folks at minimal salaries do incredible work, put in huge amounts of overtime, hard work, win cases, and the second point I often make is they don't just litigate, they advise. And often when an indigent person comes to a legal services office and the attorney looks at the situation, it's simply a matter of a phone call or a letter from an attorney to an obnoxious landlord or to whomever that solves the problem and avoids litigation. So we have a system established for 40 years, almost 40 years now in Alaska, that helps avoid litigation. And when we do go to litigation on behalf of the client, it streamlines the judicial process so that it addresses the very point brought up before. Judges aren't in the position of trying to help one side of the litigation along, help them stumble through the legal and judicial process. Some folks who have some animosity toward attorneys think that attorneys just clutter up the system, but in fact, I think you'll find that virtually everybody who has direct contact with the judicial system, as well as the whole system of justice, would find that having an attorney, that someone who's analyzed the law, the statutory law, the legal precedent from courts, knows the system, knows the procedures, can help people through that system, help assure their rights, help assure their relationships with other people, so that we don't have street fights to resolve personal disputes. We have a judicial system. This Legal Services Corporation helps provide that assistance to low-income individuals. And to address the question that arose earlier about the definition of low-income individual, as I recall, that's essentially the same one we've used in Alaska Legal Services and other low-income related types of programs. For that 125%, there is a statute that specifies the Alaska level that's 125% of those poverty guidelines. You have in your materials, I believe, a graph that shows that Alaska Legal Services at one time back in the early mid-80s received $1,200,000 from the legislature. That has gone down to the current fiscal year of zero. And it's not because there are fewer disputes, fewer clients, or people are any nicer to each other. It's because that there have been some decisions made to reduce that funding. This current fiscal year, the legislature cut the prior year's appropriation in half, and then the governor saw fit to zero it out. I don't understand that way of thinking. I think it's certainly a blow to one of the most efficient programs in the state using a certain amount of state money. We make a huge effort in collecting money from other sources, private individuals, from $10 contributions to $1,000 to, and you know, some of us have a pipe dream of getting a $50 million endowment so that we will be self-sustaining and won't have to come back to the legislature for additional funds. But this bill provides just one source that will help it along a little bit. If we get that $100,000, that would do more than provide an attorney's salary. We could perhaps open another office. I don't want to speak to that. Andy Harrington can address that kind of question, but any little bit helps, and this bill would be a help. I'd be happy to answer any questions or try to.
Great. Questions for Senator Terrio.
So currently the money coming from that source just accrues to the general fund.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman, Senator Terrio.
Other questions? Senator Guess, any questions?
No, thank you.
Mr. Harrington, you're online. If you'll put yourself on the record, I'd appreciate if you'd give us your testimony today.
Thank you, Senator Seekins. Yes, my name is Andy Harrington, and I'm teleconferencing from Fairbanks. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Legal Services Corporation. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. And I appreciate Ms. Michelle's work on this as well. Some of you may not be familiar with Alaska Legal Services. Some of you may be, some of you may not be. For those who are not, we're a legal aid firm, a charitable 501c3 that provides civil legal assistance to low-income Alaskans at no charge. We are not the same as the public defenders or the public advocacy offices, which provide representation as a matter of right in criminal cases or parental right termination cases. We only provide attorneys in cases where the law does not recognize a right to an appointed attorney, but where the consequences at stake in the case are significant for the family. For example, loss of shelter or income or health care coverage or the right to be free from domestic violence. Our eligibility ceilings are set by the Legal Services Corporation at 125% of the poverty level for Alaska. We have 8 offices around the state. We recruit through the generosity of private attorneys, volunteers, through our successful pro bono volunteer attorney support program, which handles between 100 and 200 cases at any one time for our low-income clients. We also make legal information available to the general public through a series of clinics offered by our staff and by pro bono attorneys through the Alaska Law Help website. In short, our mission is to provide meaningful access to justice in resolving civil legal problems for low-income clients, thus promoting family stability and reducing the legal consequences of poverty. Now, this idea in this bill stems from an Alaska Supreme Court Task Force report issued in 2000. It turns out that providing representation to low-income clients helps the court system function more efficiently for everybody, including the judges and including other litigants. A civil case in which one or both people are unrepresented takes more time and attention from the judge and also increases the chances that the judge's decision will be based on incomplete information. The study also found that the clients served by legal services, Alaska Legal Services, probably represent only a small portion of those in need. The bill, as Mr. Michelle mentioned, would create a designated program reserve from revenues flowing out of Alaska's civil cases, that is, the one half of state court punitive damage awards that go to the state rather than the plaintiff under current Alaska law. I want to tell you a story about just one of our cases, a woman who came to our Anchorage office in December having lost an eviction hearing. It's very difficult to get a court to revisit those eviction decisions. In this case, the young staff attorney in our Anchorage office who took this case on dug into the matter and learned that the woman had formerly owned the house and it entered into one of those too-good-to-be-true refinancing arrangements with an outside firm, losing the house in a foreclosure. But Alaska law, in fact, gave her significantly more protection than she had been given in this transaction. And after a laborious weekend, this attorney filed a case. Shortly before the hearing, the attorneys for the other side made a settlement offer. And as a result, this woman had the eviction set aside. She recovered not only possession of, but her ownership interest in her house, and got $11,000 in this settlement shortly before Christmas, all without the judge having to hold the hearing or make a ruling. The $11,000 was not much to this business firm, but it meant the world to this client and her family. And although this young attorney is about 6'2" and skinny as a rail and very dark skin, that family thought he was Santa Claus this past December. The legislature, and this bill is important because the legislature, while admirably maintaining its commitment to equal justice in criminal cases, has been forced by fiscal necessities to not provide commensurate support for low-income Alaskans who are being faced with civil legal crises over the years. This bill represents a creative approach to bolstering that commitment. We greatly appreciate your willingness to consider it. I have two kind of technical comments. One does have to do with the point that Senator Guest raised. Our eligibility guidelines are set by the Legal Services Corporation, and those are set at 125% of the federal poverty guidelines. The federal poverty guidelines for Alaska are set at 125% of the federal poverty guidelines used in the contiguous 48 states. And I think that creates some confusion sometimes. I think that it, for our eligibility requirements, it would be preferable to have one of two changes made, either on line 13 after the third word or less than, to put in 125% of, and then continue with the federal poverty guidelines for Alaska. Or alternatively, in place of lines 13 and 14, to use or less than the maximum income level for Alaska set by the Federal Legal Services Corporation. And I apologize for not having been able to bring that up ahead of time. It's it's not Mr. Michelle's fault at all. He and Mr. Hove and I were trying to communicate last week and over the weekend, and it's again, we appreciate their hard work on it. The second comment that I had was I guess the bill may need an effective date. But aside from those two technical points, again, we really appreciate the committees and legislatures willing to consider this. It's very heartening for me to be able to pass along to the staff who work for much less that we're able to pay them than they could get if they were working for the state or in private practice, that the legislature does have their efforts in mind and their commitment to equal access to justice, and is willing to consider a bill like this to support that effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Harrington? Senator Terrio?
Yes, we've been given this packet of information regarding the funding, and I'm just trying to figure out the connection. Well, a couple questions. First question, I'm sorry, before I jump to the funding issue, Alaska Legal Services, does it oversee the state bar's pro bono program or mesh with the pro bono program?
It doesn't oversee it, but yes, we cooperate very closely with it. The Board of Governors of the Bar Association has a pro bono coordinator, a woman named Krista Scully, formerly headed the youth courts, and she's very capable and very competent. Our pro bono coordinator is a young man who lives in the Mattoon Borough, Eric Cordero. We work very closely with them. The Bar Association does not place any case. The function of that individual is to recruit attorneys and make them available to, but not to actually place cases. Our coordinator assists in the recruitment and then actually calls up the attorneys to try to place the cases with them. So we work closely together, but we're not in charge of the Bar Association's program.
Okay, so on the sources of funding here, and Mr. Peterson has talked about state funding going down to zero in the current fiscal year with the governor's veto action. But then I have a separate spreadsheet here that talks about state dollars, and it says in 2003, the last reported dollars here in the column under state, $327,000. That doesn't match up with the graph that showed fiscal year 03 at $175,000. Now, the little note down on the bottom talks about the support and revenue includes grants, contracts, interest income, litigation income, donated services, which I guess would be your pro bono operation, and the gain on disposition of property and other. But we've got a column here on the spreadsheet for federal dollars, state dollars, other dollars. So I'm just wondering, why is there the disparity between the graph and the state dollars, and where are we historically here with the funding?
I appreciate the question through the chair, Senator Theriault. The reason for that is that the figures on the chart are taken out of our audited, the figures on the chart are taken out of direct legislative appropriations, which came to Alaska Legal Services through the Department of Community and Economic Development and formerly through the Department of Health and Social Services. The figures on the table come from our audited financial statements. Those figures for state funding include several numbers, grants that are made to us through organizations such as the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, through the Alaska Children's Trust, through the Municipality of Anchorage, and through the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The money from the Municipality of Anchorage is partly Human Services matching grant money, for which Alaska Legal Services applies competitively with other nonprofits in Anchorage. And our auditors classified all that money as state money, despite the fact that I think 30% of it is borough money, 70% of it is matching state money, and all of it Alaska Legal Services gets by filing competitively with other organizations. So the figures in the table include money that is received from these other sources. The chart reflects direct appropriations made by the legislature for Alaska Legal Services.
Okay, and with the passage of this legislation, you're not proposing that all of that money be funneled in here through this new separate sub-account in the general fund, just that the punitive damages get appropriated in there, sort of, so they're tagged as a funding source for your operations. Is that correct?
Yes, that's absolutely correct.
Okay, and would there be a one-year lag in the way you envision this fund working, so that this year the legislature would appropriate all of those funds that would come in under the punitive damages? They would then gather up over the course of one fiscal year and be available in the next, or would we estimate the amount that would be appropriated in there and then appropriate from that estimated bucket of funds?
I would think that probably for the first year would need to be an estimate. My envisioning of how it would work in the long run would be that the money would accumulate in the bucket, as you have put it, and then the legislature would be making its appropriation decisions based on how much had accumulated in the bucket during the fiscal year preceding the date on which the legislature is making its decision.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, the only reason that I ask is just to, if we take action here, we need to convey to the Finance Committee, although the bill is routed up through their committee, that it would seem to me the way that this will have to work is just have general verbiage in the budget this year that all funds that, you know, meet this certain description get appropriated into this subaccount.
Right.
Then next year, the legislature would know, have a dollar certain that they would know that they can appropriate from for the purposes of actually providing the legal services. So, and it, of course, would be up to the Finance Committee and the legislature as a whole whether to continue to have the general appropriation language that collects up the funds to make them available in the next appropriation year.
Correct. Thank you, Senator. Other comments or questions for Mr. Harrington or Mr. Peterson? Thank you very much, gentlemen. We do have Bill Oberle. You said you were still, are you still with us, Bill?
I am, Mr. Chair.
And you had some testimony to give on this, if you would put yourself back on the record, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Oberle. I am the private attorney and the president of the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers. And unlike my last testimony, this will be on behalf of the trial lawyers. And I just wanted to say, myself, like I think most members of the trial lawyers, appreciate the work of the Alaska Legal Services Corporation and take part in that work. I do a monthly landlord-tenant clinic through the Legal Services Corporation where I provide information to tenants who are having problems. I also take cases from their pro bono coordinator, Eric Cordero, as do most, if not all, of our members. So my testimony is just that I think this is an excellent opportunity to fund an organization that's doing invaluable work in the state of Alaska. I think it is a necessary source of funds for them, and so the Academy supports this legislation, and we'd like to have that on the record. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Seeing none, I think what we'll do here, is there any preference on how we would want to establish, from committee members, on how we would want to establish the income question, the definition of low-income individual, whether we should use a percentage, as was suggested, or we agree to the guidelines that are set by the Alaska Legal Services Corporation.
Mr.
The National.
Chairman?
I'm sorry, the National Legal Services Corporation. Senator Guest.
I would like to hear from Andy on what he suggests. My gut feeling says that we would want to use the second approach only because if they see needed changes, they can make them at that level versus having to go through and change the statute. But does the person working on the bill from Fairbanks have a suggestion between the two approaches?
Mr. Harrington?
Thank you, Senator Guest, through the chair. I would agree. I think that putting in a generic reference to the maximum income level for Alaska set by the Federal Legal Services Corporation would avoid any necessity for having to come back in case the Legal Services Corporation at some point in the future changes its number up or down or sideways or something. So the generic language would probably be preferable from that perspective.
Other questions, Senator French?
Just on that point, I take it the national body looks to each state's cost of living and sets a number specifically for that state.
That's correct, although what they do is they set that figure currently at 125% of federal poverty, which means that the only two states that they look at that have a different number set for them would be Alaska and Hawaii.
Okay. So the intent here will come, will Mr. Harrington will and Ms. Peterson will have staff work with you to come up with we'll put together a CS that will incorporate an amendment to the definition or clarification of the definition of low-income individual, and we'll incorporate language on the appropriation side that Ms. Senator Terrio brought up and bring it back to the committee for further consideration. With that, tomorrow we will Once again, we'll try to complete our work on Senate Bill 56, and if we can get a CS back in time for us to complete our work on Senate Bill 19, those are the two bills that we will consider tomorrow. Are there any other comments from anyone? Senator Terrio?
Yes, Senator Guest, do you have access to a fax so that with regard to a possible letter of intent, my staff can send it up to you to take a look at if we get it back?
Thank you, Senator Chair. Unfortunately, I sent my fax machine down to Juneau.
Okay.
So if you can get it in email form, I am online, but I haven't figured out how to receive faxes yet up here.
Okay, and that would just be through your legislative account?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. If there's no further business to bring to the committee, we're adjourned for the day.